Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. I'm Edward LaBar for the defendant appellant Darrell Havens. LaBar number is 8116. And this matter comes before the court on Havens' appeal of the denial of his request for a hearing on a criminal procedure Rule 35C motion for post-conviction relief. And the first question, of course, is the standard of review. And this de novo. So it's not a question of whether there was an abuse of discretion. It's you decide whether or not Mr. Havens should have a hearing on his criminal P35C motion. And then there's a standard of the question of what is the standard for determining whether he should have a hearing. And that's really the critical issue, I think, in this case. And that's been set out fairly well by both the United States Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court. First, the United, or I didn't say first, but there's the Sanders versus U.S. United States Supreme Court case, which was followed by the People v. Pickrell case. And in those cases, the court decided, or determined, or ruled, that no matter how improbable the allegations of, in that case, unconstitutional factors affecting the defendant's plea were, no matter how improbable they were, it still might be that the defendant's plea was entered in violation of his constitutional rights. And in the Pickrell case, it was similar. It was not a question of really whether or not the defendant's assertions are credible. It's whether or not he sets forth allegations that, if true, would entitle him to a 35C hearing. And the defendant doesn't have to set forth these facts in the record or in his motion. He simply has to make the allegations that are, if true, would allow him post-conviction relief. And Darrell's done more than that. Mr. Havens has done more than that. He produced some record to the judge about the basis for his claims that his guilty plea was entered in violation of his constitutional rights. But the only way that he should have been denied that hearing would be if what he alleged were true, he still wouldn't be entitled to relief. But what he alleged did entitle him to relief, or does entitle him to relief if it's true. And he alleged four different grounds for that. And the first one, and I think this is a very significant one, is that his plea was not entered intelligently and knowingly. And he states that he was on strong morphine-based painkillers and muscle relaxants at the time he entered his plea. And there's some basis for that. His sister, who was at the hearing, said that he was nodding off. We know that he's a quadriplegic, and he's a quadriplegic as a result of being shot through the cervical spine with a .45 caliber bullet. Now, that's certainly something that's going to take some time to recover from. And as is typical for people in that situation, they're paralyzed, quadriplegic, although he has a little bit of use of his right hand, he's subject to recurrent infections, bladder infections, urinary tract infections, and other things. So he's constantly being treated. In fact, he had just recently been released from the hospital and was on strong morphine-based hydrocodone, however you say it, and muscle relaxants at the time he entered his plea.
Well, Mr. LaBar, even accepting as true he was on the medications and there was some allegation that he had nodded off during the proceeding, I think the question we need to focus on is, did the fact of those medications somehow influence him not to enter a knowing, intelligent, voluntary plea? And so the question is, looking at the record, does it appear that he was able to do so? And I believe the court here did inquire specifically about his medications and whether it influenced him. And so I'd like you to address that.
I'm glad you raised that issue, because the courts have been clear, People v. White and some other cases, that you have to look beyond the record, because what's in the record, as in the U.S. versus Sanders, Sanders versus U.S. and the Pickrell case, you have to look beyond the record. In fact, Mr. Pickrell stated on the record that he was not under the influence of drugs. He stated that he was not coerced. You know, he asked if he was satisfied with his attorney's representation. He said, you know, yes, I'm satisfied. No, I'm not on drugs. No, I'm not under coercion. And the court said, we have to look beyond that. No matter how regular the proceedings may be, if the defendant makes assertions that, if true, would entitle him to a hearing, then he gets a hearing. So I hope that answers your question. We have to look beyond that.
Well, I do have a question because I know that Von Pickerel addresses that issue, and I'm not sure that they had a record of the providency hearing, whereas we do have a record of the providency hearing where the court specifically said, I am aware you are on medication, and did some inquiry. So did that in fact end the inquiry, or why would we need to look beyond the record in an instance where they specifically address the issue?
Okay. Well, I can address that, besides the fact that of what I already stated. Now, if you are asking somebody, are you under the influence of drugs or anything that might be affecting your thinking at this point? Okay, the person answering that question might not really know the true answer to that. That's like asking somebody who's an alcoholic if he's under the influence of alcohol, or somebody who's intoxicated if he's drunk, or drunk if he's intoxicated. The person might say, if he said yes, well, then you can say you probably got a good answer. If he says no, you don't know if you got a good answer. You know, you don't know. And in Mr. Haven's case, when he's taking hydrocodone, which we know causes some euphoria, you know, you don't operate heavy machinery, you shouldn't drive a car when you're taking hydrocodone or muscle relaxers, there's a reason for that. And so if he's taking those things, he may think that he's fine. Doesn't mean that he is. And he finds out later, ooh, what did I do? I don't remember that. I don't even remember being in court that day. So that's a little bit different. And the same thing with his other grounds for appeal. Now, he was asked about, does he know what's going on? Well, he thinks he knows what's going on. Does he really know what's going on? Does he find out later? Because he was, as I mentioned, a quadriplegic. He can't page through things. He can't go get books. And when he got to prison, he had prisoners helping him turn the pages. And he began to develop some memory for this incident. And he says, oh, that can't be. And so he learns things as he's reading it later, as his memory starts coming back to him when he's actually able to do this. But I'm kind of getting off the track here because I had an order in which I wanted to do this, but I hope that answers your question.
Counselor, before you move on, in the Rule 11 advisement, he does more than just answer yes or no. He actually responds to questions in a cogent way. How would you address that insofar as that is proof that he was aware of what was going on around him?
Well, again, I refer back to the Sanders case where it says no matter how regular the proceedings may appear, but I'll answer that question too. He says, can you read? He says, well, the words aren't too big. So apparently he has some understanding of what the judge was asking him. He was asked if he knew what was going on or knew what he was pleading to. He said yes. But also, you have to think about this. He's in a situation where he's been told that he better plead to this or he's going to get 96 years. And he's looking at that and somebody is saying, you better do this or else you could be in real trouble. So he's been told you have to answer yes to this, no to that, yes to this, or you're going to, the judge isn't going to take your plea.
Is there anywhere in the record that shows he was told he had to answer yes to all these?
Or an allegation to that effect?
Well, in his 35C motion, I think he made statements that he didn't really know what was going on, but he didn't say this is what I was told. I'm just looking at normal procedure for criminal attorneys. You have to go over that with your client ahead of time and say, you're waiving this right, you're doing this, you're saying that, and if you don't do that.
Isn't one of the duties of a criminal defense attorney to tell the defendant what he's facing?
Of course.
And how can that be a grounds then for coercion if the defense attorney simply does what he's supposed to do?
Well, that's a good point. And coercion is not one of the ones that we have a basis for on the record. Not that we really go by the record, but he certainly has the fact that he's drugged, and that it would seem that should be enough right there. If he alleges that I wasn't thinking clearly, I was on strong morphine-based narcotics and muscle relaxants, and I didn't know what I was doing, that ought to be enough there. But I want to, if I could, move on to another issue, and that has to do with his newly discovered facts. And when he's in the situation, the condition that he was getting out of the hospital and quadriplegic, he couldn't learn of the facts that he later learned about so that he would understand, hey, now, wait a minute, I didn't know about this. Well, importantly, Rule 35C says that the facts must have come to light after the guilty plea that either the defendant or his attorney were not aware of. It doesn't say neither nor, neither the defendant nor his attorney. Darryl, later, when he was reading some of these things, learned about, well, first his memory came back to him as he's going through it. Certainly as he's going through the facts, he's going to say, I remember this, that can't be. For instance, he would say, before I even got my car stopped, before I did anything, all I remember is flying back in the seat. And then he starts reading about how he ran this and did that, and he says, that can't make any sense. So those are things that he learned after he entered his guilty plea that are facts that are new to him that he couldn't have learned in the condition that he was before he entered his guilty plea. It just, you know, to me, it just seems raw that if he's on those pain medications in that condition that he was, that he couldn't be expected to know everything that was going on. But yet, that's basically what the prosecution is saying. Well, he said he did, so he must. Something else I wanted to mention, because I see my yellow lights coming on.
Counsel, let me ask a question. If he had, it's not clear to me what his alternative would be. I guess you would say he should have gone to trial under those conditions.
Well, that would have been, you know, the alternative at that point would be to go to trial. Because if he went to trial, somebody would have to take a little closer look at the record. And if they took a little closer look at the record, they would say, these are material contradictions, material inconsistencies. And it wouldn't be the first time somebody went to trial in a criminal case where their client couldn't testify either because he couldn't remember or because of some other reason. But if you're a defense attorney, you defend people on material inconsistencies, material contradictions in the record, because you have a different, you have that a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And Darryl has for his civil rights case that he has now, he has a proof beyond a reasonable doubt on him, and yet there's enough concern. But I want to quickly touch on this Fifth Amendment issue in his parole before I totally run out of time. And that is, one of the grounds for having a 35C hearing is an illegal incarceration. And if he's being held after being granted parole, having a parole date for medical parole because he was unable to be treated in the prison because they couldn't take care of him, then he's being subjected to cruel and unusual punishment at this time. He's in prison because pressure was put on the parole board not to release him because he wouldn't sign a release for the police, which there again adds credibility to his allegations that there was more going on.
Well, the release he was asked to sign was several months after his parole was suspended. I don't think it was ever, he never got to a revocation stage.
He had a parole date. Uh-huh. Before that date.
It was months later that this alleged allegation about the release being signed occurred, right?
I don't believe that. Yeah. I think that he had a parole date, January something of 2010. And before that date got there, he was told that it wasn't going to happen because of some other matters that came up with real vague reasons, and then he didn't get it. But the point is, he was in a prison where they could not take care of his medical needs. They knew that. They said that. That was the reason for the medical parole. Yet he's still there getting bladder infections. He's basically got a death sentence for his assault because prison can't take care of him, but they won't release him on a medical parole. That's a constitutional violation right there.
Well, Mr. LaBarre, let me ask you this, because my understanding is the allegation is that this was an unlawful revocation of parole, and that's the issue before us, is whether or not whether the court correctly decided the issue.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because it goes to the issue that I saw in the defense brief about whether or not parole statutes were violated. Maybe there weren't any parole statutes were violated, but the Constitution of the United States is the highest law of the land, and right behind that's the Constitution of Colorado. Those are laws. So that makes the revocation of his parole illegal, because he's being held in parole despite the fact that the prisons can't take care of him and he needs medical needs. So that's wrong. That's a constitutional violation. It may not be a parole statute, but it's illegal.
And what the illegality of the parole decision not to, the parole board's decision not to release him on parole, the illegality would be?
That the illegality is that they can't take care of him, so it's cruel and unusual punishment to have him in prison. He's a quadriplegic getting infections all the time, and they can't treat him. So, time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. The defendant challenges the trial court's summary denial of his 35C motion to withdraw his guilty plea. He alleges that he's entitled to a hearing on his claim that his guilty plea was involuntary. The first claim regarding whether his guilty plea was involuntary has to do with this medication issue. He claims that he was so heavily medicated at the plea hearing that he was unaware of his surroundings. Now, the defendant has a heavy burden once he's pled guilty to allege facts that show that the medications affected his decision. The record doesn't support those allegations. The record shows that counsel and the trial court were aware the defendant was on medications, and that in fact the trial court engaged the defendant in a colloquy regarding these medications. And the post-conviction court found that there was no indication that the defendant didn't understand the proceedings at the plea hearing. As a matter of fact, it was the same judge at the plea hearing as in the post, I'm sorry, at the plea hearing as at the post-conviction hearing, and things like demeanor are very important, and that judge was there to witness.
Ms. Brady, let me ask you this, because we were talking about it with your opposing counsel, is no matter how regular the proceedings may appear, sometimes you need to go beyond the record to determine whether or not the medications actually influenced him, and that was his argument. So I would like to hear your response to that.
It is true that sometimes you may have to go beyond the record. However, the defendant has to make specific allegations in regard to what was happening to him at that time, and he really hasn't done that, not enough that would be sufficient for a hearing. Basically, he just blanketly relies on Von Pickrell, which has already been discussed a little bit. The trial court distinguished that case and said, no, you don't go outside the record just across the board. You have to allege specific facts, something that occurred outside the record, which the trial court found there's nothing here that occurred outside the record. There's no allegation of that. Everybody knew the medications that he was on. Further, as has already been pointed out, there was no plea transcript in the Von Pickrell case, and there was no means for the prosecutor there to dispute the defendant's allegations. These days, Von Pickrell was in 1967 on subsequent cases, and what we do these days is we do rely on the record unless there's something specific that the defendant can allege that would entitle him to a hearing. Also, I'd just like to mention under 35C, there's really no right to discover things outside the record. It's the notion, the files, and the record. So if you want a hearing, you have to make allegations in order to, you can't do what the defendant is trying to do here. He wants to do discovery to look through the record to see if there is something there that would entitle him to a hearing, but that's backwards. He first has to make allegations of what is in the discovery that he didn't get in order for the court to grant him a hearing.
Okay, just to clarify, you're discussing about the subpoena issue?
That's correct. Counsel said something about how, you know, he would need discovery to find out things that we always get discovery in a 35C hearing. Didn't we always go outside the record? And that's not true.
If a hearing had been granted, he would have been entitled to such discovery. Or might have been. It would have been something the court could have considered. Right?
The court can consider it and deny it. I believe that the defendant is relying entirely on Crimpy 17. There's no case law, at least I have not found any case law, and there's none cited in the defense briefs, that say that the defendant can just do a blanket discovery to get ready to discover evidence that he could use. He has to allege that there's evidence out there, this is what it says, and this is where it is. And just briefly on that newly discovered evidence claim that the defendant mentioned, the first prong of newly discovered evidence is, you know, what is the evidence that's newly discovered? And here we really don't have anything that's been alleged other than the defendant said his memory has returned.
And why isn't that newly discovered if in fact his memory improved over the exist whatever memory he had at the time of the plea? Why isn't that newly discovered?
Well, that is newly discovered. The trial court did find that there was no way to know his memory was going to come back at the time the plea was entered, and obviously he did not have memory at that time. But then the defendant doesn't go on and allege what is it about his newly discovered memory that shows the second problem, which would be that the charges are false or unfounded. So then the trial court went to the next thing that was alleged.
Well, he's saying, isn't he, that, well, now I've seen this, now I recall that I wasn't ramming people. I didn't have a memory at the time of the plea hearing, but now I recall that I didn't ram anybody.
Right.
Isn't that newly discovered evidence?
Well, correct. That's his part of the memory that's newly discovered evidence, but that doesn't show that the charges are false or unfounded. That's just his allegation that I didn't do this. And there was already inconsistencies in the discovery between the police officer's statements in regard to who rammed who first and that type of thing. So as far as does he have something just based on his memory alone that shows that the charges are false or unfounded, that's no. And then if we skip to the third problem, would this evidence, his memory returning, probably bring about an acquittal? And the trial court found no. Inconsistencies in regard to statements do not prove that the allegations are false, of course, and a jury would not probably acquit defendant on basic evidence that's just, it's just for impeachment and cross-examination.
So can a question of conflicting statements, credibility determinations, can that ever meet the test for newly discovered evidence?
It could, but it would have to be newly discovered and it would have to be pretty overwhelming. There are no further questions?
Well, I do have a question on the allegation about the denial of release onto parole.
Yes.
All right, so could you address that issue?
Well, the argument that the people have made in the briefs is that, and I believe this has already been brought up, there really is no jurisdiction for this court to review what the parole board did. It's a discretionary decision. It did exercise its discretion, and the defendant doesn't cite to any rule or statute that was violated by the parole board. And that would be the only basis for this court to review that decision.
Well, today I believe he's relying on constitutional cruel and unusual punishment. So can you respond to that?
The defendant did not raise that in his brief. It's not briefed, and he raised that for the first time. So I don't really have any response to that. I could give a written response following this argument.
Was it raised in the trial court?
It was not.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, both of you, for your excellent arguments. And the case is submitted, and we will render a decision in due course.